You're listening to Radio Berkman from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. You can find show notes for this episode and more programs like this at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman.
Did you hear the news? I'm going to make records.
No kidding!
It's kind of hard to imagine a world without Google. When the search engine first emerged in 1997, it didn't seem like all that much, in contrast to the dominant search engines of the time like Yahoo, where search results were curated more by topic. Google was a blank canvas, a simple search box that let the algorithm do most of the work of parsing out a user query and presenting a simple list of results. But Google quickly went on to become the market leader, and having revolutionized search, Google moved on to making, remaking, and dominating almost every other sector of the web, from advertising to analytics to email, maps, and video, and more. And they moved beyond the web to take on moonshots like renewable energy and self-driving cars. Many observers credit starry-eyed co-founders Larry Page and Sergey Brin for the rapid success of Google, but it has been a rocky road, and Google's corporate idealism has often clashed with the practical realism of running a company, including antitrust investigations, lawsuits, and brushes with international conflict, in particular a tense relationship with China that has all the drama of the Cold War. Stephen Levy, a senior writer for Wired, recently completed a detailed account of Google's rise in the Plex, how Google thinks, works, and shapes our lives. I recently sat down to talk with Stephen over Skype about his new book.
The book posits a kind of thesis about Google and how it's come to be, and part of that is that there are fundamental values to the web, and Google has sort of taken advantage of those. And I wondered, what are the fundamental values of the web? And how has Google sort of helped to take advantage of them, or in some cases shape them?
You know, where Google is in sync with the web is the ability to reach many, many people and to take in a huge amount of data. The ability, you know, and speed is another one, the ability to process things in real time. And, you know, also the flexibility to put out something and get feedback on it right away and then change it. Instant and scalable and flexibility, and allowed Google itself to scale and act quickly.
In some ways, the web has kind of come of age with Google.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think what happened was that, you know, the function that Google performed was to find things anywhere on the web, made possible a lot of, you know, websites and services that couldn't find an audience otherwise. So Google was an enabling technology to help make the web get bigger. If you remember what the web was like in the early days, it was really hard to find things. And, by Google making things, so easily locatable, and, by allowing businesses to put up websites and know that if they were selling something obscure, their potential customers would find them, Google allowed the web to get bigger, and which was fine for Google because of all the early search engines, Google was the only one that got better as the web got bigger. The rest of the ones of the services didn't take advantage of those links there. So the more stuff that piled in, the bigger burden they had to analyze pages and figure out what words were on pages. For Google, it made things easier because there were more links and they can get better at serving the searchers what they wanted.
And as they were starting out, that was sort of the core of their business. Has that just become a small department of what Google does, or is it that kind of core to how they exist as a company?
No, it's still central to Google. Search, and you have to think of search and ads really as a match set there. So, because the Google's ad model really is dependent on the search engine. The AdWords that accompany the search results are, you know, almost a magical combination. It's a very rare instance of advertising that people like and that people find useful. When Google does tests to show people results without ads, they don't search as much as they do with the normal set of ads on the right-hand side of the screen there. 70% of their efforts are in that core function of search and ads.
You've profiled the founders of the company, Sergey Brin and Larry Page, and the two founders, they left the company, didn't really leave the company, but they left the CEOing to another guy, Eric Schmidt, pretty early on in the founding of Google.
Not by choice, really. Google sought out its original venture capital financing in 1999. They did something, you know, audacious, which was in character for them, by taking not one, but two of the leading venture capital firms and making them co-lead investors there. Usually they're big dogs, and you know, they don't like to share, you know, the kennel with another dog. So, you know, it was Sequoia Capital and Kleiner Perkins there. The venture capitalists together, Mike Moritz from Sequoia and John Doerr from Kleiner Perkins, put a restriction on them. They said that, you know, you have to find an experienced CEO because this company is going to grow a lot. It's going to be pretty complicated. And you're a couple of graduate students. This isn't your field of expertise. So that was the understanding when they got the $25 million combined in venture capital. But a few months afterwards, they called John Doerr and said, we want to do it ourselves. We don't want to find a CEO. And Doerr said to them, well, listen, why don't we do this? Why don't I send you on a tour where you get to meet a lot of the CEOs in the Valley and you understand what's involved in this? You might have a better idea after you have these conversations. So they met with Steve Jobs and Jeff Bezos.
And they were particularly impressed with Steve Jobs, weren't they?
Yes, they came back and said, well, we did find a person we like, Steve Jobs. We like him to be our CEO. And Steve wasn't going to work for two kids from Stanford. He had his hands busy with Apple, and that was what he wanted to do. But John Doerr did convince them to take another look at some other people, and they lit on Eric Schmidt, who became the chairman and then the CEO in 2001. And after a couple of years of adjustment, you know, they were a little rocky, they really came to appreciate him. And Schmidt very cleverly didn't challenge them, make them feel that he was taking over their company and they didn't have a say. So that worked out to be a very productive troika over a number of years.
It's hard to think of a more different leader than Steve Jobs, perhaps, than from the vision that Larry Page and Sergey Brin pose with Google.
Yeah, that probably would have been a disaster, even if they had gotten him. Steve would have demanded that he be, you know, the CEO with 100% control. And Eric Schmidt never made that demand. Eric sublimated his ego and his authority to become part of a troika, where two of three votes would be, you know, sufficient on big decisions. Or in cases where it went to the board would sometimes support Larry and Sergey's view of a problem over Eric's. For instance, when Google had made a very big decision early on to compete very aggressively to be the search company for AOL. And at the time, AOL was riding very high, and it put a big demands on it, you know, that basically you had to guarantee a certain amount of money, that would go to AOL. And if Google didn't earn back that money, it would have been bankrupt. And Eric was cautious about it, and Larry and Sergey wanted to go for it, and the board supported Larry and Sergey.
It also seems that Google has, over time, created a counterpoint to the Apple model of success, which has been Apple has become profitable through creating kind of a closed system. Google has shown that they can become the third largest technology company in the world without putting licensing fees on a lot of their products.
Right. Well, the Google business model, again, is tailored very much to the internet, which is to spread things very widely. Unlike some other companies that have been so successful, Google then has, a way, once it gets that attention and those eyeballs, to make a lot of money there. So it fits Google both philosophically and financially to pursue things in that direction, make things free in almost all cases to users, and still be very profitable.
You talk about Larry Page in the book as a different kind of character. He's got some really grand visions for the company, way beyond what they've been doing over the last 10 years, perhaps.
No, Larry is an ambition junkie. Even from a very young age, he set very high goals for himself, and he felt he was very much into thinking of big ideas, and he feels really strongly that the only way to go is just to pursue big, ambitious ideas, and particularly ones where you'll do some good for the world. When we had a very long interview for this book about a year ago, this to me was the biggest point that he wanted to get across. And after we talked for 2 hours, he actually came back to the table where we had been sitting at, and wanted to talk more specifically about that point, about how people aren't ambitious enough. They don't take on big enough tasks there. And that's what he wants to do all the time at Google. He's into what's sometimes called Google moonshots, like book search, or more recently, the idea of building cars that drive themselves, which he was fascinated with when they did a contest at DARPA and the Stanford AI lab. Won the contest with a car that drove a couple hundred miles in the desert. Larry brought that team and some others to Google, and they've driven over 1,000 miles on California roads with the driver not putting his hands on the wheel or his foot on the accelerator.
I can certainly see a market for that. Is the market something that Larry and the folks at the top of Google are worrying about or even thinking about when they pursue these moonshots?
I don't think in that case the specific market is all that well thought out. But I actually, Google's come under some criticism for that program, and I think that if you really understand Google, you see it really is in keeping with the company and its missions and its approach, because those cars really are data processors and learning machines. They just take in all the information about their environment, and they use information that Google gets in Maps, and they'll probably feed back information to Google's Maps, and it'll be something where information will find its way into Google's system. So even without people without Google making a direct financial connection to cars that drive themselves, that technology can wind up being pretty useful to Google there. And it's one of those artificial intelligence projects that Larry Page just loves.
One of the other moonshots that they've taken is with Google Books. And it's been funny following that process and then reading some of the excerpts from your interview with Larry Page. A lot of people have been upset about the Google Books project because Google has sort of gotten a monopoly over these orphaned books. Larry Page's response in your excerpt was like, well, I just don't understand. Why is it that people, who wouldn't want access to all the world's data easily and quickly as possible?
That's right. I mean, he's looking, from the point of view that it is a good to society. And, and I have to say, it is a pretty amazing concept to be able to just type some words into a search field and the thing would just like dive into some obscure book at a university library basement somewhere and give you a relevant passage in there. I think where Google ran into trouble there was it proceeded without a real consciousness of how people now react to Google as a big company there. Google was offered the opportunity to settle the lawsuit, the copyright lawsuit filed by the publishers and the authors, for the act that Google did of physically copying, a single copy of a book and then putting it in its index. The Authors Guild actually suggested like a bigger scheme where Google would not only do what it had intended to do, but would sell books as well and do a registry and, can really be the nexus for selling all these books. And I think that was that was doomed because, you know, in part, you know, competitors and other people who were worried about Google's power would object on that basis. If it were a different company or a nonprofit, maybe there wouldn't have been that outcry against it.
But it's something that's there's a consistent concern over almost everything that Google does, a fear of them becoming a monopoly over every market that they've taken on. Search has been a big one, that there's been some antitrust allegations or antitrust investigations supposedly happening around that. And I can see it from Google's perspective in that if they are true to their, you know, their core values and the do not be evil mantra, you know, that people would be fine with that. People should be fine with that. But people are more concerned with the precedents and the and hypotheticals that this raises.
The search monopoly charge is kind of interesting because Google really earned that share by merit. It wasn't the kind of thing where people are locked into a search necessarily. Even if you use Firefox, which might use Google as the default search, you could always switch. It's not like switching an operating system where, you know, you've got all these applications that run on it that you'd abandon if you switched over to a different operating system on your computer. But, you know, because of Google's dominance in search, when it takes on other areas, it has a natural advantage sometimes, which you could see why, you know, there would be interest in the Justice Department to make sure that power isn't concentrated, that Google doesn't use its search dominance to get an unfair advantage in other fields. So that's why I think quite rightfully, you know, every big purchase that Google makes comes under very close scrutiny by the Justice Department. And that's just a fact of life for Google from here on in.
Let's talk about how Google has been expanding its products internationally. They're kind of, as they've helped create the web in some ways, they've also helped create a new world, not to be too grandiose about it, but they've been trying to make contagious the openness of the web into an openness of societies, and particularly in their expansion into China, this has caused some problems for them.
That's right. Well, international has always been a big push for Google. Really, as any technology company has to see itself as global to be really successful there. So it's not unusual in, you know, attaining, you know, about half or so of the revenues from overseas there. China presented a particular problem for Google, of course, because it's a search company, and in order to operate in China, to get a license to operate, you know, in the country and make money in there, it had to get the approval of the Chinese government, which it wouldn't get unless it submitted to government censorship, which was abhorrent to it morally, which was to filter the contents, the political things, and, you know, sometimes even, you know, uncomfortable stories about the Chinese government officials. That was particularly a tough pill to swallow for Sergey Brin, who his own family history was that they emigrated from Russia because of government oppression and anti-Semitism. So Google made that decision because it constructed sort of like a moral spreadsheet where they said, well, okay, I guess we're going to go into moral debt. There's a red cell in the spreadsheet for censoring the search results. But on the other hand, we might do some real good in China by giving people information about other things and telling them when we do censor. They'll put a little thing on the bottom of the page saying there's information that we can't give you, which Google, you know, insisted on providing. And indeed, Google's competitor Baidu wound up doing the same thing. It turned out to be that compromise didn't end there. I was surprised when I visited Beijing and spent a week there in 2009. It was my second visit to Google offices. You know, and spent a lot of time with the engineers and found that the number one problem out there was that the engineers couldn't get access to the Google code base to develop products, to improve on Google's products there. And that was a huge
bone of contention there because they felt they were being treated like second-class citizens. There was almost a riot at one point because they were so unhappy about it.
What do you see as the kind of strategy going forward for Google and any tech company with a similar concern in China going forward?
They're between a rock and a hard place. Microsoft has chosen to operate amorally, let's say. They've said things like, well, we're following the laws of the nation that we're in, which, you know, is a pretty flimsy way to present yourself. There were actual congressional hearings. This happened right after Google made its decision before they implemented their China search engine. You know, representatives from Microsoft and Google and Yahoo and Cisco had to testify before Congress. And, you know, the Congress brought up IBM's behavior during the Holocaust, where IBM cooperated, you know, to some degree and provided tools to Germany, which helped it run the concentration camps more efficiently. You know, obviously, we're not talking about concentration camps here, but we are talking about denying people human rights. So I think that that's one unfavorable or unfortunate way to, or undesirable way to deal with the situation. And, you know, another way to do what Google does, which is give up a lot of business and, you know, be on the right side of morality.
Right. They do give up a lot of business, but they, you know, they definitely save themselves the potential for a lot of trouble as well. In Google's case, there was some concern over the, you know, the hackability of Gmail accounts of human rights activists.
Yeah, what happened, that was the, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back, is, you know, the expression used quite often by a lot of Google people. You know, the thing that really led them to pull out their of China in terms of their search engine. Well, basically, they said they would stop censoring, which de facto meant that they had to leave. That was particularly intolerable to Sergey. He was appalled when he found that the attack on Google had led to Chinese officials getting access to people's Gmail accounts. Now, you have to remember, these Gmail accounts weren't stored in China. You know, Google doesn't operate from its Chinese Gmail, from its Chinese websites, because it doesn't want to be in a position where it served the subpoena to say, give us, the identity of this user here. There was one case during that period where they discovered that one of the people whose attacks was whose accounts was attacked was right there at Stanford. It was a Chinese dissident who was posting from Stanford, and they immediately went and got her laptop to examine it to see what was going on there, whether it was still on there, and they found that by that point, the code that violated the account had very expertly been retracted there. There was no sign of it. So that pointed to them that it was a very sophisticated attack.
It's one of the most interesting things about Google, and I think it's what makes Google really interesting to study as a technology company or as an institution of any kind. They have been able to go head to head with China. In a way that they're being put on the same plane.
I actually wouldn't call them on the same level as China. I would say that people have talked about Google's foreign policy, and if you'd follow the WikiLeaks cable, certainly the Google struggles with China were very prominent in the discussions there of in the highest levels of the State Department.
There's another question here about whether it's right for a company to be moving forward on these issues. Here in the U.S., the State Department has kind of struggled to keep up with Google and other companies as they're pursuing these interests abroad. Do you see that as a deficiency?
Well, I actually think the deficiency really came, and this arose, my impression arose from that very hearing that I mentioned earlier, which I attended actually before I started writing the book in 2006, is that basically, Google was left on its own, really, to sort through these very difficult issues there. The U.S. government didn't give it at that point, and this is during the Bush administration, any cover whatsoever, Google or the other technology companies who had to get through this. It didn't set rules. If they passed a law saying a company cannot cooperate with oppression in X, Y, and Z manner, then that would have given Google cover to say, hey, we'd love to come in there, but we can't censor. And maybe that kind of pressure would have allowed Google to give to have more leverage than they would have just operating on their own there. So, you know, in a sense, Google, you know, I don't think Google took on, you know, a role, you know, which, you know, overstepped what it should be taken. You know, it was forced into dealing with these political and moral, you know, international issues simply because, you know, its own government didn't give it any cover. Under the Obama administration, Secretary Clinton is, has spoken, forcefully in, against internet oppression and things like that. But there's nothing concrete to help these companies negotiate these problems any better.
Where do you see Google going in the next 10 years?
It's pretty unpredictable, really. I think, putting Larry back as the CEO really adds, an element of unpredictability because, he does take such long shots. He's inclined, to do that. I think that if you look at Google and its ambitions, they hire people who are the best computer scientists that they could find there, and they take on really, big issues there. Larry loves and is fascinated by the potential of artificial intelligence there. He's a big supporter of Singularity University. I think in addition to, taking on, more prosaic challenges like the Facebook challenge and social networking, he's also going to have an eye on, like really audacious, long-term projects there. So if they pull off just a couple of those, that could really remake Google and give it a shot at doing what no company in technology has really succeeded at, which is overcoming the innovator's dilemma of being, the company which is, really creatively solves a big problem and is a pioneer in that, and then is also able to handle the next big paradigm shift. So Microsoft couldn't do it. Before that, IBM couldn't do it. And let's see if Google is any more successful.
I'd be curious if their investors are concerned about staying profitable as they pursue these moonshots and these dilemmas going forward.
I don't think the profitability is in question. The question is whether Google will be able to grow on that. So if you look, Microsoft's been consistently profitable for the last 10 years, but the stock's been stagnant because it really isn't growing. There's no reason to think that the Microsoft in 10 years from now is going to be the master of a new business. Google wants to be in the position that Google 10 years from now might not only be getting money from search ads, but have a whole new revenue stream of something that we can't even think of now.
Well, thank you very much for your time. This has been wonderful having you, Stephen.
Okay, thank you, Daniel.
Stephen Levy is a senior writer for Wired Magazine and the author of In the Plex, How Google Thinks, Works, and Shapes Our Lives. Find links to more about Stephen's work, including an excerpt from his book, at our website, blogs.law.harvard.edu/Media Berkman. This episode of Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.